Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. Welcome to all of our visitors. Looks like we have a number of you today, and we're especially happy to have you with us. On the one hand, on the other hand, you probably picked a lousy day to come, but we're glad you're here. At any rate, we appreciate, as Mr. Fauché said, the enthusiastic singing and the fact that there are a number of us here. We would have even larger numbers, and I'm going to add 5 to our number because the Waddells were here, but Rhonda had some pretty severe pain, and I anointed her, and they went back home. So we still have a fairly large crowd, and for a change, you're neither Democrats nor Republicans. You have sort of mixed, and we have the room sort of filled in a scattered way as opposed to having everybody on one side of the room. I had to sneak over there in the last minute and give Mr. Pierce back his anointing oil because I grabbed his when I was about to anoint Rhonda. And I realized before I started up here that if somebody had an urgent need during the services, he wouldn't know where his oil was, or he'd have to come up here and dig it out of my pocket. So I took it by to him. I have some back there, but I left mine where he wouldn't find it either. So I hope that none of you needs that anointing today. Glad to see you feeling basically healthy and well, as am I. I'm not 100% yet, but certainly doing a great deal better, and appreciate your prayers, as do all the others who have asked for them, and always have quite a number who have done so. We had a deacons meeting earlier, as I had mentioned previously that we would do. We had a deacons meeting for about an hour and 10 or 15 minutes, which is the maximum we normally would like to take on the Sabbath to do that, even though it's virtually all Sabbath material in one sense. And as I said to all of them, for them it's volunteer service to the church. The problem is it's partly my job. I don't want to do too much of that kind of work on the Sabbath, though again I don't think the line might be as fine as we might sometimes draw it. I don't want to be too generous with it either, on the other hand. So here we are. I will have some announcements later between the two sermons, and have a number of things that are happening we'll try to bring you up to date on. I only half facetiously made the comment about a lousy day to come. For those of you who are guests, I mean, I think when you normally go to a service, of course, you primarily go, if you're visiting, to be among other brethren that you don't see very often. Maybe you have the chance to fellowship a little bit differently. But you also go to hear somebody different speak once in a while, and here I am. But at the same time, I'm on the schedule twice today. I have the first split sermon, and I also have the second split sermon. That's a pretty unusual scenario, but we set it up that way because, as I told you in the past, I wanted to finish up the material on the finances of the church that I started with the sermon on tithing about a month ago. And so a month ago, I gave a sermon on tithing and the biblical foundation of tithing, where we saw that God commanded his people, Israel, to tithe to him. And it was quite clear that it survived, that commandment survived the change from the old covenant to the new covenant. And we saw, among other things, that tithing is one of the ways we engage in keeping the first commandment to put God first in our lives. And it is an integral part of our worship of the Creator God, who owns everything and says that he owns everything and really doesn't need anything from us. What he needs is for us to understand that he is the owner and the creator of everything, and to accordingly give back to him what we metaphorically call rent on what he has given us. It was not my intent on that day to cover the entire subject of tithing, much less the whole range of financial principles covered in God's Word. And certainly I did not do that. However, because I think, tend to think in the broad picture, in the big picture, I inadvertently mentioned at that time third tithe. And an old timer later responded, you mentioned third tithe today and I haven't paid third tithe in years. Well, there's a reason for that, and that's okay. But I didn't realize that inadvertently I'd maybe raised a red flag in somebody's mind. So first, to avoid confusion, let me make it clear what third tithe is, since a few of you may not know. Third tithe is and would be, in that sense, a full tenth of our income paid as an extra tithe every third year, or actually twice in 7 years, because God works on a seven-year cycle. So in the third and sixth year of our conversion, we used to pay an extra 10% of our income to the church. And of course, it was set aside for the purpose of taking care of the needy. It was set aside specifically for the widow and the orphan, but over time it has also been used in principle to care for others, including the elderly or the infirm. And the church felt that we had an obligation to do that, partly because it was the way we were reading the tithing law in the Old Testament, knowing that tithing had survived the change to the New Covenant. We brought the whole thing over, and in one sense that was correct and would be proper, except for the government and the world in which we live. For many years now, the church has no longer taught that we must pay a full tenth of our income every third year for this purpose. Why? Well, because, generally speaking, we live in what is increasingly a welfare state in this country, as much of the rest of the world has for many years, and a very high taxation nation, in which the government takes responsibility for the needy, supposedly takes responsibility for the same folks we were trying to take care of, and taxes everybody else to pay for it. And so you and I come into the tax system in the same way that we come under the tithing laws, and we are responsible for paying our taxes, and those taxes include all kinds of extra taxes in the sense of FICA and other things that we pay in order to support the government, and other income taxes, of course, are also allotted for that purpose, appropriated is the word they use, for that purpose, so that the government takes responsibility for a great deal of what we might call the public welfare. And I don't mean welfare roles per se, but the public needs and public good. And so many people who are elderly, people who are infirm, people who are disabled, people who have special needs and so forth, often are helped by money from the government. Over the past few years, in fact, those of you who fill out tax returns will know that they've even added something called an earned income credit, and you actually end up getting money back from the government that you didn't put in. And so there are ways in which the government taxes and spends that affect the way the tithing system actually works in the church today. Let me explain that very briefly. I think all of you know in ancient Israel, the tithing system was both a tithe for spiritual purposes, for supporting the Levites and the ministry and the temple and all of that, but it was also a physical civilian tax as well, because the government was administered as a theocracy. Whereas today, of course, we have a strict, theoretically, separation of church and state. I saw the other day that, forgotten who it was, but one of the major TV evangelists had come out openly endorsing Mr. Romney for president. I looked at my wife and said, how can he do that? One of the rules of a 501c3 corporation, which most of these churches are and we are, is that you are not supposed to openly engage in political activity. Actually, you're not supposed to engage in it at all, but they know you do. They just don't let you openly engage in political activity, which is what he was doing. We judged long ago that certain nations were extracting such a level of taxes on people that there was no way they could pay a third tithe. In fact, most of them were stretched just to pay first and second tithe. You thankfully had some ways around some of the taxes. Otherwise, places like Norway, which, as I recall, when I was in Pasadena in the early 80s, Norway, the tax rate was something like 93%. So you take a 93% tax rate, what does that leave you? Well, of course, there were various things, not a lot of deductions and all like we have in America, but they didn't have a lot of money left over after they'd paid their taxes, but the government was taking care of a lot of the needs. And so that made us understand, and Mr. Armstrong judged 40 years ago probably, that some of those nations simply could not be expected to pay third tithe, and in some cases maybe not all of their other tithe, because the government had usurped the authority and taken it away from them in advance. You cannot give what you do not have, as you've heard him say many times. And so the government had taken away from people even their tithe. And so we had to make some judgments in various places about how Christians would apply some of those laws. And for a period of time, we even tried in the late 70s to make this a little less burdensome to people by saying you're actually paying 20% of your income over that 7-year period. And so if you stretched it out year by year, it's only about 2.8% per year. So if you want to pay it year by year, just add 2.8 or 3% to your tithes and offerings, and you will be covering your third tithe obligation as well. Well, we recognize that that too had been usurped by the government, and so in reality, the government is taking away your third tithe before you ever get your hands on it, and then they claim that they use it to take care of the needy. And we have accepted that now in the sense that many of our own brethren are receiving not only Social Security benefits into which we paid, but we realize also that we don't pay into Social Security nearly as much as we ultimately receive, especially as the longevity of people increases, life expectancy is the words I'm looking for. As the life expectancy increases, people pay less and less into Social Security before they retire, and they end up drawing more because they live 30 or 40 years after they retire, which is not the way it was in 1935 or 7 or whenever it was first enacted. So we do receive more from Social Security than we put in. Now, one of the things the church just recently did was ask us all if we had Social Security benefits in our future. And if I had them in my future, I'd have them in my present because I would qualify age-wise. But I do not have Social Security benefits. There's a reason for that as well. The church for a very long time did not encourage the ministry to pay Social Security for various reasons. And we are legally exempt. And I filed a form clear back in 1968 that says I don't pay Social Security taxes. And I cannot pay Social Security taxes on my ministerial income. If I went out and worked at McDonald's or, that's probably as high as I should go, Burger King maybe. If I went out and worked in one of those places, I would be paying Social Security into that from that income, but I can't pay from my ministerial income. So we do not have Social Security. At any rate, I did work a fair amount. Though it doesn't show up very clearly on my Social Security record. I worked a fair amount through college and before I came to Ambassador in my early college days and in my early married days before we came down to Big Sandy, I had worked a few jobs and I have a Social Security record. So they asked, well, would you please review your record on the Social Security website and send in the information so that we can look at where our ministry is in terms of what we should anticipate for future retirement, future health issues, etc. So I did that, and you know, they used to count it by how many quarters you added up and so forth. Well, I think mine came out to 14 quarters in which I had paid Social Security. They now count it, by the way, by other means, credits and income of various kinds. But I had 14 credits, which means I would still need, 26 more to qualify for Social Security. And I looked at that, and I thought, wow, I would have thought there was more than that, but at the same time, I looked at the taxes that I paid during those years. My total input to Social Security over 14 quarters, I paid Social Security taxes of $359. But if I had actually qualified going along for another few years, I would probably be drawing a reasonable amount of Social Security today based on my $2,000 or whatever that I put in. And so you can partly see why the Social Security system doesn't economically make sense anymore, because people aren't putting nearly as much into it as they eventually are drawing out. And since I plan to live a long time, I would be one of those people that would hurt the system. But what you plan and what happens are not always the same thing. However, all of this government takeover does not relieve us, does it, of our Christian duty. It relieves us, in a sense, of the application of the tithing law the way we had previously applied it, and that has all been taken into consideration so that we no longer collect third tithe as a church, though you often hear us talk about an assistance fund. And that is because the government benefits often do not take care of our brethren. They often do not take care of the needs of our people, and so the church sometimes has to step in. We'll come back to that a little later. I want today to tie up some of those loose ends without again giving an absolutely thorough sermon on the subject. I want to tie up a few loose ends from the past sermon and maybe help us to think about a few other things as we come to both the Feast of Tabernacles and the way the church is now conducting its finances. If you go back with me to Leviticus chapter 25, and many of us are reading through this Pentateuch and on into Joshua and Judges now as we read through the Bible reading program that's posted day by day. In Leviticus chapter 25, I'm just going to give us a few sample scriptures and maybe comment a bit to help us put them together. Leviticus chapter 25, verse 10. I'm breaking into this, but "and you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants." Those of you who have visited the Liberty Bell know that it says proclaim liberty throughout the land and to all the inhabitants thereof. That's taken directly from this scripture with a slight modification of the wording. But that is what God told them to do in the 50th year. "It shall be a jubilee for you. And each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you shall return to his family. That 50th year shall be a jubilee to you." Now today, if we use the word jubilee in public, people think we're having some kind of a big fancy gala of some sort, because in fact, that's what it was. It was a great time in Israel when everybody was able to return to their homelands and basically be released from their debts and their property exchanges and all of those things and put back on the land that was given to their family at the time they came into the promised land under Joshua. So he says, "That 50th year shall be a jubilee to you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of its own accord, nor gather the grapes of your untended vine." So he's saying in the 50th year, you do not plant and sow and reap. But, you know, if you read it carefully before, what I skipped, you also have a year of release in the 7th year, and you don't plant and reap in the 7th year either. So in the 49th year, you're having a 7th year in which you don't plant and reap, and then you turn right around, and in the 50th year, you have a jubilee year in which you don't plant and reap either. And so God was certainly giving them an act of faith, but he was also showing them his power to make that work. Verse 12, remember it said you should not gather or reap. Verse 12, "For it is the jubilee, it shall be holy to you. You shall eat its produce from the field." So you can go in the field and eat, as can other people, as we'll see in a moment. But you do not use that crop as a cash crop or as a crop that you reap and store. It is something that's set aside for a very special and holy purpose in God's eyes. So the Jubilee had tremendous benefits for people who had moved away from the land, who had lost the land due to debt, who had sold lands. The only places that were reserved for purchase that did not have to return to the initial owner, you'll read in other places, was the was a townhouse. If you bought a house in the town, in the city, then that became your permanent property and you didn't turn that back on the year of the Jubilee. But if you bought in a village or you bought a farm, you bought land, the year of the Jubilee, it went back to its rightful owner. You can see how that economic system would totally change where we are today. Now, God was not against people building wealth and being able to change the equation, but he wanted people not to lose out on what they had been given and to end up with nothing. And so he provided various things like the year of release and the Jubilee. And what these things show us is that God is tremendously loving and kind and generous, that he owns everything and he decides how it will be shared and how it will be used. That's God's prerogative, just as the tithe is his prerogative. If he says, "Send to me the tithe," hey, he owns it all anyway. Who am I to say, "No, God, you gave me 100%, I'm going to keep 100%. No, you gave me 100%, you tell me what to do with it. And he tells me to give him 10% of it and then keep 10% of it to keep his holy days so that I don't forget who he is and that he's the creator God who put me here. So we begin to learn some things about God and the way that he thinks. Let's go to Deuteronomy. That's Deuteronomy chapter 14. Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 22. We often read this in the first day or two of the Feast of Tabernacles because it is the instruction regarding going to the feast, but it also includes something about money. Deuteronomy 14:22. "You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year." So this is every year, year after year. "And you shall eat before the Eternal your God in the place which he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of your grain and of your new wine and your oil, of the firstborn of your herds and your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Eternal your God always." So we've come to understand that this is what the church has historically called the second tithe. Today we often call it a festival tithe, and it's one and the same. It is a festival tithe that's set aside for keeping the holy days. And when God tells us to take it and go and eat before him, that's different than the first tithe, which he commands us to give to him at the temple for the ministry, the Levitical priesthood in the old days, and as Hebrews 7 shows us, the Melchizedek priesthood today. And we covered all of that in the first sermon. That's a little sop to those of you who weren't here for the first sermon. I'm kidding. We did cover some of that before. Verse 24, of course, says, if the journey's too long, take the money and go instead of taking your cows and your sheep and your produce. And people do that. There are parts of the world, by the way, where brethren still carry their chickens and their goats and so forth with them when they go to the feast and actually slaughter those animals for food during the feast. But that is not common in most parts of the world. It certainly isn't here in America. And so in verse 26, he talks about spending that money and for what your soul desires and so forth. And then coming down to verse 27, he says, and here's the principle, not about the ministry, but about the giver. You shall not forsake the Levite who is within your gates, for he has no part nor inheritance with you. Remember, that tribe did not have an inheritance. They couldn't go out and plow their fields and see how much they could make and reap and do business on that level. They were limited to the ministry. And so you shall not forsake the Levite who's within your gates, for he has no part nor inheritance with you. At the end of every third year, you shall bring out the tithe of your produce of that year and store it up within your gates. Now notice, that's that third tithe I was talking about earlier, which is different. This is stored up within your gates for a different purpose. The second tithe, or festival tithe, you take with you to the feast, and to the holy days, and you spend that money basically on yourself, and we'll see later on a few others. But you spend that money for the keeping of the feast days in honor of God. But this is the third year, and it is a tithe that is laid up in store. Verse 29, and the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance with you, and the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow who are within your gates. In other words, those who don't have resources, they don't have access to productivity and income, perhaps because they are on a journey, as the stranger would be. They are fatherless. They are a widow. They don't have a breadwinner in the home. May come and eat and be satisfied, that the eternal your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. So he says, you're laying up some money, produce and food and so forth, for others who are needy to take it from your hand. And we'll see as we go through these scriptures that these all tie together. And what God is really saying is his people need to be concerned with those who are less blessed than themselves and need to be able to help people when they need help. And that has, of course, always been a hallmark of God's church. I can look back over, coming up on 49 years now. Look back over 49 years in the church. By the way, congratulations, Dr. Erickson. I think he's coming up on 49 years of marriage. That's how I know he's older than I am, because I've got another 6 months to go before I come up on, another 2 months. 2 months. He's 1 month ahead of me. His 49th comes 1 month before my 49th comes. But we came into the church at the same time we were married. So I look back over 49 years in the church, and I can say that God's people have always been extremely generous. They started, in my experience, by being generous to me as a young, dumb, whippersnapper coming into the church. And I have seen them be generous to many, many people down through the years and have tried to follow that example myself and do what I can to help others when the opportunity arises. And God's people have always done that. So this is not something that should surprise us. The point is, it is God's mind. It is God's character. It is God's way. It is God's attitude. Even as we said in a previous sermon, God's law was his attitude and mind and way of thinking. And so this matter of giving and sharing and generosity is also God's way of thinking and functioning. Let's go to chapter 26 of Deuteronomy. Chapter 26, verse 12. Now, we just read there that in the third year we'll take that money and store it up. Let's notice what he says in Deuteronomy chapter 26. We probably should start in verse 11 instead of 12. For some reason, 12 is in bold in my Bible. It looks like a publishing accident. So you shall rejoice, in verse 11, in every good thing which the Eternal your God has given to you and your house, you and the Levite and the stranger who is among you. When you have finished laying aside all the tithe of your increase in the third year, dash in my Bible, the year of tithing, dash, and have given it to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, so that they may eat within your gates and be filled. Let me pause there and go back and notice this. Theologians have a problem with this. They think we're crazy for talking about third tithe, but they can't quite figure out why it says in the year of tithing. The third year, dash, the year of tithing. The very description of the third year is it's a year of tithing. Why is it a year of tithing any more than any other year? Because that year there was this extra tithe to be put aside for the needy. Again, which the government has usurped and does on our behalf today, but doesn't do a very efficient job of it. Probably collects a great deal more money than it expends for the right reasons. Probably eats up an awful lot of it in administrative costs and overheads. All right, but he comes to the end of verse 12, when you've done all of this and they've eaten and so forth, then you shall say before the Eternal your God, notice, this is a statement to God. This is how you come before God in prayer. You come before God and say, I have removed the holy tithe from my house, also have given them to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, according to all your commandments which you have commanded me. I have not transgressed your commandment, nor have I forgotten them. I have not eaten any of it when in mourning, nor have I removed any of it for an unclean use. That sometimes becomes a problem, not just with formerly the third tithe, but with second tithe. People sometimes set aside their festival tithe, and then times get hard, or there's some kind of an emergency, and they say, I have to dip into my festival tithe to get by. That's a mistake, brethren. Don't ever let yourself be deceived into doing that. That tithe is as holy, in one sense, as the first tithe, even though you're going to spend it on yourself. So don't be deceived into thinking that the second tithe is sort of a slush fund you can reach into, and most people do it, of course, with the great intentions of, I'm going to put it back before the feast comes. And I have known people and counseled with people as their pastor who came to me at the feast and said, I need some help because I'm not able to get home. And you say, well, did you have enough money when you came? Well, not really. Well, did you save your second tithe? Well, yes, I did, but I had this situation. I had to spend a bunch of it, and now I don't have enough. And I really just came here on my last paycheck. What? You came to the feast on your last paycheck? Yes, because I didn't save the appropriate funds to keep the feast. You can never really go and enjoy the feast with a certain level of abandon where you say, I'm free to spend, I'm free to buy whatsoever my soul desires, I'm free to rejoice before God, and I'm free to give to others, I'm free to entertain others, I'm free to take the needy out to dinner. You can't do that if you don't have the money, and you can't have the money unless you save the money. So there's a law in motion here that the level to which we're able to keep the feast and rejoice in the feast is based upon that commitment to doing what God says. Here, of course, he's talking about the third tithe, just so we're clear. I'm not confusing you here. He says, I've not taken from it, in other words. Middle of the verse, I have obeyed the voice of the Eternal my God and have done according to all that you have commanded me. Then here's the request. Look down from your holy habitation from heaven and bless your people Israel and the land which you have given us, just as you swore to our fathers, a land flowing with milk and honey. So the tither says, God, I did what you told me. Now please bless me. And again, I've seen this many, many times over in God's church, where people who are faithful in tithing, even though they may be borderline poverty level, have been able to make ends meet and many times end up with blessings they didn't anticipate. And of course, often we don't even see some of those hidden blessings that God gives us by the things that should have happened to us, but don't. We see the positive blessings when God clearly intervenes and jerks us out of the mud hole, but we don't always see the fact that God steered us around the mud hole in the first place. That too is a blessing. So as you read the scriptures with an eye toward financial principles and God's way of thinking, you see over and over again that the family of God is very generous, that God gives whatever we need, that God gives everything, that God didn't have he didn't have a demand on his life to call Abraham and bless him and bless his family and bless our nations today because of Abraham. He's just that way. He's generous. He's loving. He's kind. He's good. And he is very concerned that we learn to think and then, of course, to act the way that he does, to think and act like the God family does concerning money, resources, and goods. Christ himself was very clear on that. Let's go to Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6. You've probably heard this on repeated occasions during Holy Day offerings and so forth, because it's a principle that applies to economic situations, regardless of what specific situation we might be talking about. Luke chapter 6, verse 38. Among the other commands that he's given here, love your enemies, don't judge, etc., he says in verse 38, give. Just that one word, give. That's the command. Give, and it will be given to you. Now, this is Jesus talking. He has the capacity to make this happen. These are those laws in motion that we talked about before that have consequences when we do them. Give, and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over. So you don't just get back what you gave. You get pressed down, shaken together so that it fills all the air holes. You ever get one of those ice cream cones where you think this is a beautiful cone and you take one bite and it's all empty inside? You know, they didn't put any ice cream in the cone. In fact, sometimes I have walked out of a place on a warm day and before you get more than one or two bites, the top falls off on the ground because they didn't put any ice cream in the cone. It's all air down there. God wants it pressed down and shaken together so that it's compact and tight and full. It's abundant. Pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be put into your bosom. I think it says in the King James, men will give into your bosom. For with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. Again, just a principle in motion that as we give, it comes back. Cast your bread on the water and it'll return to you. God has a principle in motion here. And it works without God's personal direct intervention in the sense that we think of it humanly. His law is in motion. He's sustaining his law by his word. And when you get in harmony with his law, it works. And it produces good results. And when you contradict it, it hurts. So Christ was simply saying, one of the things you need to do as a Christian is to give. And it will be given back to you. You don't give in order to get the blessing back. You give because you want to give to the other person. But God's way is you get a blessing out of it too. And most of us recognize and have experienced, if we've had the opportunity and the wherewithal to give, especially anything of any significance that we feel significant about, we give something away as a sacrifice. Feels good. Feels good to see somebody else walk away with something they wouldn't have if you hadn't helped to provide it. And to know that your work and your labor and your effort and your willingness to do it has made a change in their life and in their well-being for that moment. Whether it is an ice cream cone or whether it's a full meal or whether it's, you know, the rent paid for a month, which some have done. I should know better than to do this subject in a split sermon because there are too many stories, but I'll tell you one really, really quick one. I remember in my very first pastorate, after I left Houston here and went to West Texas, we had a young family who were struggling. The father was in school. They were barely getting by, but he was trying to get through school so he could make a good living. And he was continually having his old car break down and one thing or another. And one day I just happened to walk into the service. I came from 180 miles away, and I just happened to be walking into the service as one of the other members held out a set of car keys to this young man. And he said, here, he said, there's a such and such outside. He said, these are the keys to it. And the young man said, well, where do you want me to take it, or what do you want me to do with it? And he said, nothing, it's yours. He said, these are the keys. And he handed him the keys to a relatively nice car. It wasn't a new brand model, but a brand new model. It wasn't the 2-year-old model. It might have been 6 or 8 years old, but it was a very well running, nice car. And the man was just overwhelmed. And it was a tremendous example. And I've seen people do that kind of things in God's church. And again, that isn't what you have to do to be a Christian. I'm not saying that. I'm saying people who have the wherewithal and have the capacity to do so and do it are able to rejoice in it. I'm sure that the man who handed the car keys got as much pleasure out of handing them to him as the guy did driving away. I mean, we might think of it the other way around, but no, the guy doing the giving is the one who's going to be more blessed. Because it is what? More blessed to give than to receive, I think I read somewhere. So, give and it shall be given. It's a law in motion. Let's go back to Nehemiah, pick up some more specific example of activity in Israel. This is, of course, at the coming time they were coming back from Babylon. In Nehemiah chapter 8, all of these are wonderful long stories and long chapters that I don't normally give sermons where I just use one example like this, so I'm not, but I think it's very well worth reading, and if you're coming in the Bible reading program, you'll be there one of these days. Or you can read it whenever you like. In chapter 8, notice the very first, let's start in verse 2. So Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly of men and women, and all who could hear with understanding, that is, even the children, on the first day of the seventh month. Anybody recognize what that is? The first day of the seventh month. That's the Feast of Trumpets. Then he read from it in the open square that was in front of the water gate from morning until midday. Okay? So he's reading the law and going through all of these things. Coming down, if you will, to verse 8. Skipping down, verse 8. So they read distinctly from the book in the law of God, and they gave the sense and helped them to understand the reading. So you see, expounding the scriptures has a long history and precedent. We don't just do it because we think we know more than anybody else. God's ministry and priesthood clear back in Nehemiah's day was giving the sense and explaining so people could understand what the law said. Verse 9. And Nehemiah, who was the governor, Ezra the priest and scribe, and the Levites who taught the people, said to all the people, "This day is holy to the Eternal your God. Do not mourn nor weep, for all the people wept when they heard the words of the law." So they were taking it to heart, but they were also feeling guilty, of course. And he said, "Don't weep. Get on with what you have to do." Verse 10. Then he said to them, "Go your way. Eat the fat, drink the sweet, and send portions to those for whom nothing is prepared. For this day is holy to our Lord. Do not sorrow, for the joy of the Eternal is your strength." You have a gift from God. This is God's holy day. Rejoice in it. And go and do something for somebody. Send portions to those for whom nothing is prepared. In other words, those who didn't have anything, those who didn't have the wherewithal to prepare something for themselves. Give something to them. Share what you have with them. Because God, of course, sees that and God rejoices in that. Verse 11, so the Levites quieted all the people, saying, "Be still, for the day is holy. Do not be grieved." And all the people went their way to eat and drink, to send portions and rejoice greatly because they understood the words that were declared to them. They understood the words that were declared to them. They recognized that, yes, God is good, God is gracious, God is generous, God has given us every good thing, and we have the opportunity on this holy day to share it with other people. What a wonderful experience, and what a wonderful example. I hope this bottle was for the first split sermon and that bottle was for the... Otherwise, I may have them backward and it may cause all kinds of problems. So people went their way and sent portions. Now, this specific situation was probably done through second tithe. That is, they had their festival tithe, which was usable on the holy day, and they probably used it for that purpose. They don't know that for sure because the law tells them to take it to the place where God is, but that is what was happening here. So I'm assuming that even though it wasn't the Feast of Tabernacles, they may have been able to give out of the abundance of their festival tithe savings. No matter what the case, they did it and they rejoiced in it. And it is, again, a reflection of God's way of life. It shows an attitude, a mindset, a way of life, regardless of what the source of the goods or the money or the food might have been. All right, most of that that we've talked about sort of concerns tithing and third tithe and the idea of taking care of the needy. Let's go a little further here and move away pretty much from the subject of tithing itself and look at some of the other principles laid out here for us. Deuteronomy chapter 15. Don't worry too much about the time. I know how much total I have, and I need more for this than for the other. So we'll hope that we get through it all. If we don't, there's always other times coming. Deuteronomy chapter 15. Heading in my Bible is Generosity of the Poor, verse 7. Verse 7, if there is among you a poor man of your brethren within any of the gates in your land which the Eternal your God has given you, you shall not harden your heart nor shut your hand from your poor brother. Tongue twister, from your poor brother. But you shall open your hand wide to him and willingly lend him sufficient for his need, whatever he needs. Now, maybe I should comment here that this is not your beggar on the street corner situation necessarily, at least in our society. There are places in the world where when you see a beggar on the street corner, he's a genuine beggar and he's in need and he has no means of support. That's true of some people on the street corners here in Houston probably, but probably not a very large percentage of them, because I see the same ones with the same signs week in and week out, and they're homeless and hungry, and you wonder what they did the other 6 days of the week when you see them. A lot of them are making $400 and $500 a day. I still give them once in a while. I'm kind of selective when and where I give in that situation. But this is not saying everybody that asks you in that sense, just give it to him. Christ did say when a man asks, give it to him, but you got to be a little bit judicious in our society because it's become a scam. It's not people who have need, it's people who think you have more than I do and that's not fair, so give me some of yours and we'll both be happy. That's the way they feel about it. All right, verse 9. Beware lest there be a wicked thought in your heart saying, the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cry out to the Eternal against you, and it becomes sin among you. So they had the year of release, the seventh year you forgave debt. So it's the sixth year, and this guy comes and says, I want to borrow X number of dollars. And you say, whoa, I don't think he's going to be able to pay this back before the year of release. I'm going to have to give it to him next year. And so, maybe some other time. Come to me in the first year and we'll think about it. No, God says, don't think that way, because God will consider it sin to you. You shall surely give to him, and your heart should not be grieved when you give to him, because for this thing the Eternal God will bless you in all your works and all to which you put your hand. For the poor will never cease from the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall open your hand wide to your brother, to your poor, and to the needy in your land. So God says, be open and generous in the way that you interact with other people. Again, this doesn't mean you let ne'er-do-wells drain all of your income. You work hard and make a good living, and people who are not willing to work take it away from you. That's the way our government is headed. That is not what it's about. It's about our attitude and being generous, and you might have to be a little bit discerning and distinguishing between people who need and people who want, or people who want you to have what they have, as opposed to they want to have what you have and you to have what they have. So again, we're not talking about random beggars on the street, though from time to time it's probably wise to give to them as well. Exodus chapter 23. This street corner down here at Cullen and Interstate 8 has become big business corner. There are always people on that corner. Sometimes they're passing out flyers or coupons or whatever it is that's the come on to get you to participate in something they're doing. Sometimes it might even be a good legitimate fundraiser for a very good cause. But you get a little tired of pulling up to every stoplight and having people at both windows asking you for money. It just gets a little old. And you certainly can't do that all of the time. And that's where the old saw I gave at the office first came from, of course. You have to be able to make a good excuse, and I don't do that, but that's where it probably came from. Exodus 23, verse 10. 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its produce. We're still in this cycle of 7 years now. But the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow. Okay, we could stop there and say, here's a law that God put in motion that doesn't make sense. just don't sow your crops in the seventh year. Let the land lie rest, at rest. But that's not the end of this command. That the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave, the beasts of the field may eat. In like manner, you shall do with your vineyard and your olive grove. 6 days you shall do your work, on the seventh day you shall rest, etc. But you see, the principle is that when that rest takes place in the seventh year, it produces for somebody else. That your land Sabbath becomes a bonus and a windfall for those who don't have a land to let lie, because in some way they have lost it or squandered or whatever, and they can come and eat. So God is not saying there should not be anything eaten there. He says they should come and have freedom to come and eat. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 19. Pick up another principle. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 9. Leviticus 19, verse 9. And this is repeated. We'll mention a couple of places, but it's a common theme in God's instruction to Israel. 19:9, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. And you shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. And it finishes with, I am the Eternal, your God. I created it. I put you here. I gave you this land. I blessed your crops. And I'm telling you, don't try to get every last little bit of it for yourself. Leave some of that that is left naturally in the harvesting process, and others will benefit from it. That's the way God thinks, and that was his command. And it's a principle that we should keep in mind, that there are sometimes the crumbs or the change or whatever that can benefit other people more than we might think. Deuteronomy chapter 24. Deuteronomy 24. Verse 19, we have a similar scenario, but this one includes something quite different and interesting. In Deuteronomy 24:19, he says, when you reap the harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field. I find this fascinating. You forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, the widow. The Eternal your God may bless you, that the Eternal your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. Now you've just forgotten this sheaf. Now a sheaf could be a pretty good handful of grain, you know. They pulled it together and tied it up. Maybe you've seen them standing in the fields in some parts of the world. Could be a pretty good product. But you went and took in 50 of them and you left one. And God says, no, don't go back and get that one and say, oh, I've got to have that. Leave it there for somebody else. That's remarkable. Might be one thing if you say, well, it fell out of the machinery and it's just scattered here and there, and a person wants to go pick it up and he's got the energy to do that, let him have it. But God says, if you forgot a sheaf that's already been harvested and tied together and stacked up probably, and you forgot it, don't go back and get it. It's somebody else's now. That's rather amazing, but a wonderful example of how God thinks in terms of saying, maybe if you were careless enough to forget it, you don't need it anyway. If you really needed it, you'd have been real careful to get it. I'm adding to the scripture here. I shouldn't do that. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Eternal your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive trees. Did you know they beat olive trees? Go out there with a big stick and beat the olive tree to make the olives fall, so you don't have to wait around every day and pick up a few. When you beat your olive tree, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. So you think carefully about what day harvest is going to be, because you want to obviously harvest the olives at the prime time, but you're not going to get every olive off of that tree. They're not all going to fall at the same time. There's going to be some left, and they now belong to somebody else. They're there as your generous contribution to the welfare of somebody else. But the attitude had to be right here. What if you beat your olive trees and then you said,
boy, I really like to have the rest of those olives off of that tree, but God told me not to go back and get them. And I hope nobody comes and gets them. I can't stand to see anybody eat my olives. Yeah, it wouldn't do much good either, would it? Wouldn't do much good to have that kind of an attitude. There's an attitude that goes with this, brethren, is what I'm pointing out. And it's God's attitude, and he wants us to learn it. When you gather grapes, verse 21. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not glean it afterward. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. And then you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this thing. What's that have to do with it? Well, it has to do with it that God delivered them out of slavery and gave them so much abundance and freedom that they're able to produce wonderful harvests, and they're not supposed to be greedy for every last grape on the vine. It's a beautiful example and a beautiful story. There were laws like this throughout Israel to provide for the poor and the needy. And they should have become a way of life and a golden tradition passed on from generation to generation. But that didn't always happen. Israel instead, with so many other gifts that God gave them, Israel turned their back on some of these ways. And God was, of course, not pleased when his people failed to glorify him by their generosity. Let's again just pick up one quick comment from the prophet Isaiah in chapter 3. Isaiah chapter 3, one focused scripture to see how God felt about this. Isaiah chapter 3, verse 13. Isaiah 3:13, the Eternal stands up to plead and stands to judge the people. The Eternal will enter into judgment with the elders of his people and his princes. And then why? For you have eaten up the vineyard, the plunder of the poor is in your houses. So instead of leaving the grapes for the poor, they were taking away from the poor. You get both out of this scripture. It's the converse of what Paul tells us in Ephesians when he says, work that you may have to give. Don't steal anymore, but go to work so you can have to give to him that has not. This is the reverse of that. This is saying, I'm supposed to leave the grapes in the field for you, but not only am I taking every last grape, I'm going to come into your house and take what I can from you. The plunder of the poor is in your house, which of course includes those grapes that you took that no longer belong to you. So God's judgment is pretty strong on that course, and it is appropriate. Now, the principle is the same, and let's look at Luke chapter 14. This is an entirely different context, but Christ sort of confirms the way God thinks about these things in Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14, verse 12. And we know this scripture, this parable, but we need to apply it appropriately and properly, understanding. Verse 12, then he also said to him who invited him, when you give a dinner or a supper, do not ask your friends, your brothers, your relatives, nor your rich neighbors, lest they also invite you back and you be repaid. Well, now what are we going to do? Some of us had plans to eat with family this evening after services. I mean, the Waldings came all the way down here to Big Sandy just so Melba could take them to dinner. We've got situations where we go out to eat, or we invite people over, or we have this or that. Christ is not saying that's bad or that's wrong. I hadn't told William and Julie they were buying my dinner yet, but Christ is not saying it's wrong to do this. When he says do not do this, he is talking about, again, the attitude and the approach. He is saying, lest they also invite you back and you be repaid. So you've got this social circle going where, you know, we all are well off, and I throw a party and I invite you, and you throw a party and you invite me. And you see that in the social magazines and newspapers. We get them in Katy, at least. Maybe the rest of the world doesn't live like that, but we get those things where people are bragging about their parties and their galas and all these things they do, and they you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours, and that's the way it works. So that's what Christ is saying. Don't do it for that purpose. Does this mean it's wrong to take your family out to eat or invite people over to your house who might eventually invite you back? No, it's not what he's saying. He's saying the attitude, the motive is, if I'm going to give to you, I'm only going to give to you what I expect to get back from you, because I'm not about to give something that nobody's going to give back. But when you give to somebody who can't afford, they're not able to give back, are they? So what's he say? Verse 13, but when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind. In other words, those who probably can't ever give back to you. It doesn't say you should invite them exclusively now. He's talking about including them, including people sometimes in a situation where they have nothing to offer in return. Now, you know, you have to keep in mind even the fact that some people are not comfortable in a particular environment. I've had events where there were some people I don't think would even be comfortable being there, even if you wanted to invite them. Sometimes you invite them and they say, no, I don't want to go. I don't have anything appropriate to wear, whatever it might be. So you got to look at all the factors involved here. But Christ is saying, if you're just doing it in order to sort of share what you have and let them share what they have so you can have a good time, but you're ignoring the blind and the maimed and the weak and the poor, then you've got a problem. If you invite them, on the other hand, verse 14, and you will be blessed. God always throws this in, doesn't he? And you will be blessed because they cannot repay you, for you shall be repaid at the resurrection of the just. Now, Christ is going to look at it like he does in Matthew 25 and say, in that you did it to the least of these, my brethren, you did it unto me. So it's a principle, again, about giving and sharing. It is not a condemnation of having a meal with your family or friends. Now, back to the needs of some of our brethren in the church today. The problem is that the government does not properly provide for the needy in most cases. Some cases they do, and you can get by on what the government provides. Some needy, for various technical reasons, may not even qualify for government help when they have needs. We still have many in the church who are needy in one way or another, and it may be monetary, it may be it may be company they need, they may need, you know, they may be lonely, whatever. But the point that the government is trying to provide financially does not always work. And so we still have the need to share God's love and abundance with them in the way that we treat them. And God expects us to help them out. And we do. As I've said, I've seen many, many fine examples of God's people helping out their brethren. So the church still encourages us strongly to give extra over and above our tithes and regular offerings as an assistance fund. And even if you just put a couple of dollars or a few bucks now and then on your tithe check and note at the bottom, you know, so many dollars for assistance fund, it goes into that fund, which is used to help people who have regular needs, to whom we actually send out checks on a monthly basis, and we have some of those. Or it goes into a fund that helps when somebody has an emergency and a crisis that they cannot financially handle, and that's specifically, again, for the needy, that are poor, that are in bad health, that are elderly, can't work, don't have an income, whatever the case may be. But we have those situations, and the church has always helped out in those situations. From the time I walked in the door of the church, in fact, the first time the church ever helped my wife and me, the deacon gave us a check for $25, or maybe he gave us cash, I don't remember now. I don't know if we even had a bank account. I guess we did. But he gave us $25. Sounds like a small amount today, doesn't it? But it got us over the hump. In 1963, $25 helped us through a tight spot, and we remembered that and tried to do likewise. And so should we all, not that we can repay, but that we can accept the reality that that's the way God works. So we're talking here about daily needs, not the feast, but the feast is another example, because the same needs exist when the feast comes. And right now, we're in the process of putting in applications and determining how to share the funds that are available with brethren who have need. And there will be many brethren who can go to the feast either because the church provided most of their expense money or because the church provided just enough to add to what they have to make it possible for them to go. Some people can get real close to going, but they need help, and the church tries to help. Some people can hardly even imagine going to the feast because they virtually have no way to provide that income and those expenses. And the church sometimes is able to step in and say, we'll take care of your needs, particularly for, again, widows and helpless. So we do that and have done that on many occasions. Well, there are many more things that could be said about this subject, but let's leave it for now and close this, and I'll talk to the rest of us, or all of us, I hope, services aren't over, but I did divide it into two pieces so that we would separate most of this overtly spiritual principle material from the actual financial discussion of how the church functions today and what is expected of all of us today and why, because there have been changes in the way the church does its business, and we want to explain that as much as we possibly can. So I'll conclude this one for now, and we'll be back in a little bit to talk about where we are and how we function in the financial application and present-day application of these principles in the way the church functions.